Hi, Steve.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Working from home today. It's great fun.
Special holiday edition of Blogging Heads. I'm Amy Sullivan with Time Magazine.
And I'm Steve Waldman with BeliefNet.com.
And we have a bunch of religion-related topics for this week of Christmas and Hanukkah. So, obviously, the biggest issue on everybody's kind of religion agenda over the last few weeks has been Barack Obama's decision to select Rick Warren, or ask Rick Warren to give the invocation at his inaugural swearing-in ceremony. And you've written, actually, a couple of fairly long and somewhat controversial blog posts on that. Do you want to give kind of an overview of where we are at this point?
We did an interview with Rick, interview about 2 weeks ago. He was plugging his new book, The Purpose of Christmas. And he said a lot of controversial things. One of the things he said was that in defending his position opposing gay marriage, he talked about other forms of marriage that were inappropriate, would be inappropriate, between siblings, between an older man and a child, in other words, pedophilia, polygamy. And I asked, well, do you think of those relationships as being equivalent to gay marriage? And he said, yes, I do. So this led to quite an uproar of people saying that Rick Warren, this guy that Obama just selected to do the invocation, not only is opposed to gay marriage, we knew that, not only was active in supporting Proposition 8 in California, opposing gay marriage, but he also has said these disparaging things. And it led to quite a lot of anger on the part of the gay community, but Obama supporters in general, that they'd worked so hard for this guy, and then one of the first big symbolic things he does is to invite Rick Warren, who they viewed as a homophobe, to this key prominent role. And I did write a piece sort of in defense of Rick Warren, not defending what he said about gay marriage or about gays, but making a slightly different point, which is that if you look at Rick Warren in the broader context of evangelicalism, he's a force that is trying to open up evangelicals to other issues like poverty and global warming, and that Warren has done a lot himself, as you know, in this area, and that in general, he's the sort of guy who would respond well to an overture like this, and that on balance, this would be good for Obama, but also just better for the country, and even ultimately better for understanding on gay marriage issues, that Obama did invite him, and that was a controversial position.
Well, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on kind of why you think he's being so outspoken on some of these social issues that he knows his views are controversial on right now. Just because you're right, you take particularly the last 4 years when he's become much more purposeful, not to use a pun there, about really focusing on social justice issues. He now holds this annual conference in December on HIV/AIDS. And, you know, as you said, his church is involved in a lot of work, particularly overseas. And if nothing else, he's always been a pretty savvy political guy. And he spent the past 4 years kind of positioning himself to be the go-to pastor for Republicans and for Democrats. He's had both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton into his church for these annual conferences. But it's almost as if, starting around the saddleback for him, he started to be much more outspoken, kind of poking his finger in exactly those issues where liberals who had been a little squeamish about working with him and partnering on these social justice issues, where they'd been able to say, well, we know he's a theological conservative and he's politically conservative when it comes to social issues, but, you know, he doesn't emphasize those, so we can set that aside and partner with him. And it's almost as if he's being much more explicit about emphasizing the differences that he has right now.
Yeah, it may be. We know that he's gotten a lot of flack from conservatives over the years. Right. He got a lot when he invited Obama to his church. He, up until Saddleback, as you remember, conservatives were all freaked out that he was going to go soft on Obama, and they were peppering him with questions he needed to ask, and don't forget to ask about abortion and gay marriage. And he's probably just has been hearing a lot from that part of his constituency. And I think on some level, he just doesn't realize or hasn't come to the conclusion that there's a conflict between these two goals of being sort of the next Billy Graham, America's pastor, who has this kind of rising above it all character and personality and role, and being the head of the religious conservatives. That he's in a position where he could do either one. He's really has that stature. But it's very hard to do both. As Billy Graham himself ultimately concluded, you know, early on he was pretty political, but then he got burned by it, by his association with Richard Nixon, and in the later years stayed away largely from a lot of the hot-button issues. So you're right, it's a little bit, it's a bit surprising that Warren has dived right into this. I think there may be a pedestrian explanation for this, which is he's a very gabby guy. And, yeah. You know, you ask him questions about gay marriage, and he answers them. And someone, I'm sure, asked him to support the Prop 8 thing. And I think he's not kind of putting a filter or a strategic sense of what he should be talking about and what he shouldn't be talking about if he wants to play this larger, broad, inclusive role.
Well, I think you're right.
But what do you think?
I have to admit to being a little confused by him. I don't think I ever kind of fell for the general media portrayal of him, which over the last few years has been, here's this, you know, happy guy in Hawaiian shirts who's a lovable evangelical. He's the kind of evangelical we can like, because he is so conservative. He's a Southern Baptist. This is not a guy who's a theological moderate or liberal. And he always also struck me as somebody who was extremely political, who before 2004 was very much kind of angling to get some sort of influence in the Republican Party. And after 2004, and particularly as Republicans became less and less popular, was figuring out how to leverage his support among Democrats as well, and to be, as you say, America's pastor, that seemed to be his goal. But he always seemed to be a pretty savvy guy to me who was always concerned about what his perception was. And so I guess I had assumed there had to be some reason since the summer when, you know, there was a definite break when he announced that he was holding the Saddleback Forum. There was, you know, a series of big articles, and he said, you know, it's not going to be what you think. Sure, abortion may come up, but I'm really just going to focus on four issues. I think it was the environment, HIV/AIDS, poverty, and social justice. And, you know, a month later, by the time the forum took place, as you pointed out, there may have been a question or two about each of those issues, but the bulk of the focus was on more traditional questions about judges and gay marriage and abortion and when does life begin. And it kind of seemed like he caved to some pressure on the right, but maybe that's who Warren is. So I have a have had a suspicion that maybe this is, in the last few months, been worn as his real self coming through. But I don't know. I guess the political consequences are that this makes the selection a lot more difficult for the Obama team than it would have been maybe 6 months ago, when the general perception of Rick Warren was just he was this happy-go-lucky preacher.
Now, the fact that he's a political conservative and a theological conservative, as you said, a Southern Baptist preaching in Orange County, California, that's a pretty conservative package. The fact that he's so conservative also increases the potential benefit to Obama and the opportunity for him if it plays out in certain ways. The gamble here is that by reaching out to Warren, Warren will, first of all, modify his views in some way, or at least prove Obama as justified in offering an olive branch. You know, part of Obama's whole shtick, to use a Christmas term, is that, you know, you get more progress by working with people than by shunning them. Okay, so here's a test case. He's reaching out to Warren. Now, one thing that has happened since he did this, which may vindicate the decision a bit by Obama, is that Warren has taken a couple steps. He reached out, I mean, you know, more symbolism, but he reached out to Melissa Etheridge, the singer who's the leader in gay rights, and they had a wonderful conversation, and they're buddies, and she's going to come over to dinner, and he's going to go over to dinner, and she's going to sing at the church, and she was impressed with the way he, you know, with his sincerity about this. He issued a clarification on his website a couple nights ago saying, no, he doesn't equate homosexuality with incest and pedophilia. And, you know, if he keeps doing things like that, there's a limit to how far he's going to go. But it may make people think, okay, you know, this is what happens when you try the olive branch. We're not going to convince him to support gay marriage, but maybe we can tone down the rhetoric.
Right. Well, I think that's certainly one of the reasons to invite him, is for that symbolic idea that, you know, Obama means it when he says, we don't have to disagree for me to listen to you. And there, I don't think he's talking about Warren. He's talking about evangelicals and conservative Christians broadly. And in that sense, this is a pretty powerful signal, given that just 4 years ago, there were a lot of leading Democrats who didn't even know who Rick Warren was. That was one of the favorite anecdotes that I found while I was researching my book. There was a meeting in the summer of 2004 when Terry McAuliffe and Rick Warren were introduced, and McAuliffe stuck out his hand and just said, "Well, hi, Rick. It's nice to meet you. What do you do?" It's a pretty safe bet that there aren't many Democrats right now who don't know what Rick Warren does for a living. And that, right, more than anything, I think, puts them in a better position to be able to react to him when he says things they don't agree with, but to also use him as a partner on all of the issues where they do have some areas of common ground. You know, that has been one of Obama's arguments more than anything else, is you don't just turn somebody away who might not even vote for you but could be a partner on issues you agree on.
Well, and in a way, that's exactly the fear that conservatives have. You know, I've been, one of the most amazing things after this is you go through all the message boards or blogs, whatever, on the left, and how angry they were at Obama, and then you go through the conservative blogs and message boards and see how furious they are with Rick Warren for the inverse reason. They're saying, you know, you're taking the credibility of our movement, and you're going and you're essentially, you know, putting holy water, to mix religious metaphors, on this pro-abortion, pro-gay president. You're being used, and it's a horribly destructive thing. And a lot of them are very angry about it.
Yeah, reading some of the messages.
Is that the sense you're getting?
Well, absolutely. I mean, most of what I've seen has come through people like David Brody, who are printing the messages that he's getting over at the Christian Broadcasting Network. But we also saw a lot of the same things come out after he invited Obama to his church 2 years ago.
Right.
I think there was a whole group of conservative religious leaders who signed a petition basically telling Rick Warren, you know, this is one of the enemies and you
right.
don't work with the enemy. So you're right, it's generating some heat on both sides, and I'm sure both men think that's to their advantage in some instances. But you raised an interesting question that kind of moves us on to our next topic, which is, you know, is it possible, and you asserted that it probably isn't possible, for Rick Warren to be both America's pastor and kind of the head of religious conservatives. But it seemed for a little bit there like maybe he was poised to be the face of new evangelicalism, which we, you know, defined pretty broadly, not necessarily in theological terms, but as the movement of evangelicals embracing the environment and protecting the environment as a cause, or opposing torture, or getting together to support anti-poverty initiatives. These have been some of the policy issues that have gained a lot of traction among evangelicals in the last few years, and don't always seem to be related to whether somebody is a theological moderate or a conservative, although we do see some definite changes among age groups. So younger evangelicals seem to embrace some of these slightly more centrist or liberal issues a lot more than their parents do. But just in the last few weeks, we've seen kind of a testing of the limits or the tolerance for this this new movement when Richard Cizik at the National Association of Evangelicals was forced to resign after there was a furious response to an interview he did with Terry Gross, where he said that his views on gay marriage and civil unions had shifted over the last few years, and actually came out and said that he thought civil unions were probably okay, and even left the door open, I think, to the question of whether gay marriage would eventually be something that he could accept, and was forced to step down. This is a guy who's been there for several decades, and has really over the last few years become a face of moderate evangelicalism. What's your thought about what this means for the future of that movement?
Well, and you know, not to bring it back to Rick Warren again, but I think this is telling. When I asked Warren about civil unions, and he essentially said something very similar to what Rich Cizik had said. So I got all excited about this and wrote, you know, Rick Warren just said the same thing that Richard Cizik got fired over. So what, you know, what's the deal there? Should Rick Warren be fired too? And within a day, Warren wrote me an email essentially clarifying and to some degree retracting what he'd said on civil unions, or certainly walking back from it. So that tells me, I think, that within the conservative evangelical movement, they're drawing a line there, and on that there's not a consensus around civil unions. There's certainly not a consensus even that you can have those views about civil unions and be part of the leadership. I mean, that's what's so striking about it, is that they viewed with Cizik, that they viewed that as such a point of apostasy that he couldn't even keep his job. Now, they were probably looking for a way to kick him out. They've been, you know, he's been under their skin for a long time, but it does raise questions. And I think it also, a lot of the polling that happened after the election and right before the election seemed to indicate that this interest that we were seeing with among evangelicals in some of these issues like poverty and the environment was not as widespread as we thought. You know, it was there. It was probably more than it used to be. But it was still, we did a survey on BeliefNet of evangelicals who voted for McCain. You know, they were just like evangelicals always were in terms of where they put poverty, reducing poverty was 13th out of 14 of the issues that they listed of importance. And of course, the 25% who voted with Obama were different. They did talk more about poverty and environment. So I think that this kind of burgeoning interest on the evangelical side in these other issues and the broadened agenda is there, but it's really not that big yet. That's my sense. But what do you think?
Well, I guess I would quibble with that a little bit. I agree it's probably still nascent, but I guess I would say it hasn't been tapped into more than that it doesn't exist. You know, which is to say that I think there was no question this fall that the economy was the first, last, and only issue for most voters. And so it's not surprising that you didn't hear either candidate talking directly about poverty as a separate issue, and that wasn't necessarily kind of what drove a lot of voters when they went to the polls. And it also seems like you hear more and more pastors and evangelical churches starting to focus on some of these issues. But it's been 20 or 30 years of a focus on social issues from the pulpit. And so it's going to take a little while, I think, before that really trickles down and becomes something that people kind of hold on par with the issues that have traditionally driven them in election time. And that's where it's fascinating to me to look at the numbers among young evangelicals. They voted slightly more for Obama than they had for Kerry in 2004. But we didn't see a shift of the magnitude that maybe some of us were expecting. And I think one of the reasons I personally was expecting to see more move over is because we have seen a dramatic shift when you ask young evangelicals about their positions on issues like, you know, having a more expansive and active government or pursuing peace through diplomacy instead of military intervention. On all of these issues, they take more liberal stances than their parents by extremely wide margins. And eventually, that is going to translate into some sort of political movement, not necessarily to the Democratic Party, but we see more and more young evangelicals registering as independents. Again, not necessarily registering as Democrats at this point, but they're not in the same numbers associating themselves with the Republican Party. And I don't know what the political consequences of that down the road will be, but there will be consequences because that's a whole generation. And again, it's not to say that they don't care about social issues, but it's a reordering of their priorities that's a little different from what we've seen over the past few decades.
So how do you think that'll play out in practical terms in the next year? And one thing I'm wondering about that we don't normally even talk about in the context of these religious conversations is healthcare. Mm-hmm. Because I was really struck a week or so ago that I started getting emails and press releases and things from like the Family Research Council and the conservative religious folks gearing up to oppose healthcare. It was really quite a remarkable release that they put out saying, get ready for the big fight, in effect. And I was thinking, wait, did I miss something? Did Obama, you know, sign the Freedom of Choice Act or something like that? Mm-hmm. And it was about healthcare. It was about we're about to have government-run healthcare, and it's going to force government-paid abortions and mm-hmm. government control of healthcare. And, you know, a very close alliance between the religious conservative view and the traditional conservative view in general mm-hmm. on healthcare. And I wondered how that was going to play out with both young evangelicals and even people like Rick Warren or Rich Cizik. mm-hmm. who have talked about, you know, the need to help people who are in need. What's going to happen with an issue like that? Or is there some other issue where this divide is going to get be seen more?
Yeah, well, and that also seems like the type of issue that could even divide the leadership from the people in the pews, just from a very practical standpoint. You know, people mm-hmm. are hurting, and healthcare has become so much thornier than it was, 14 years ago, 15 years ago when we last went through this. And, you know, abortion is always a pretty fail-safe way to get people riled up. But it seems like there will be some attention to that, and in terms of just kind of coming up with a solution that makes most people happy. And from there on, anybody trying to oppose healthcare reform is going to have a pretty tough fight on their hands, just because the overwhelming public support right now is moving in that direction. That's very interesting that that's what they're choosing to gear up on right now. I hadn't heard that.
Well, I wonder also, you were very you were critical during the campaign of saying that the Obama campaign could have done more than they actually did in terms of reaching out to these different communities. Do you feel like they learned a lesson from that, or did they learn the wrong lesson since they won, that they had done the right level of outreach and don't need to do any more?
You know, I don't have a sense, just because we don't yet know who's going to be kind of calling the shots in terms of, say, running the White House faith-based office or running religious outreach for the Obama administration. Obviously, when you win by a fairly healthy margin, it's not the first thing you do to look at what you did wrong. And the
evangelical
vote
was
so high for McCain that I think that really confirmed the assumption a lot of people had that it's pointless to reach out to evangelicals because they'll always vote for Republicans. But we did see, you know, in some key states where Democrats really did have concerted outreach efforts to evangelicals, that the vote rose by much larger margins than the national average. And so I honestly, I don't know whether anybody in the Obama camp is looking at those numbers right now. But they should. And I think that, again, the selection of Warren is a sign that they know this is a constituency they need to have some contact with. What worries me is that it's also a sign that they may be happy to stop at kind of symbolic gestures like plucking Warren out and putting him in the inaugural ceremony. I think he is probably a smart symbolic choice because so many Americans know who he is. But if they had wanted to kind of indicate that they know that community well and they know who the players who are trying to support progressive causes in the evangelical world are, there are any number of other people who they could have picked. Again, I'm not going to tell the president-elect that he should pick somebody who has low symbolic value to most Americans, just because it would show a handful of people that he understands the religious community. But I did find Warren to be a slightly uninspired choice, just because he seems so obvious right now. But I think we might want to move on, talking about Obama, to kind of look at a few issues along the religion politics spectrum that he's going to have to tackle in his new administration, or that he's given some indications that he wants to tackle. And one of those is the faith-based initiative, which you and I have had kind of a similar take on how successful or not that's been over the last 8 years. But why don't we take just a few minutes to talk about the myth and fact of the faith-based office under Bush, and then look at, you know, where Obama might go from here.
Well, yeah, I think it's a fascinating issue because it's one of these one topics where the basic narrative that both left and right had about Bush and religion led them both to distort what was actually happening. So he did this, Bush did this faith-based initiative because everyone on the left was convinced he was a crazy fundamentalist Christian. The story for 7 years was about how they're obliterating the lines between separation of church and state and putting religious-based money everywhere and all that. And the reality was they really didn't do that much. You know, that it was there wasn't a lot of money put against it. There wasn't a lot of effort put against it. And so Obama comes along and during the campaign says, you know, there was a problem with the Bush faith-based initiative. It didn't go far enough. And everyone on the left was like, huh? You know, I thought one of the advantages of not having Bush anymore was we wouldn't have to hear about this silly faith-based thing anymore. And then Obama comes along and says, no, I want to do it bigger and better than Bush did. And, you know, of course, everyone bit their tongue on the Democratic side. You heard a little bit of grumbling, but it was mostly private because they wanted Obama to win. They said, we'll deal with this later. But there weren't a lot on the left, of the more secular left, was not happy with that. I'm sure you heard a bit about that as well. But there is a little sort of ticking time bomb here, which is that in the course of articulating his position, Obama said, took a fairly hard line on employment discrimination, saying right. You can't discriminate against someone on the basis of their religion. So a Southern Baptist charity can't only hire Christians to do their work, mm-hmm. which, as he articulated, actually rolled it back not only to a pre-Bush position, but a pre-Clinton position, to a more really? Of a pure ACLU position. And,
that wasn't
you know, a
of
lot of progressive religious folks were kind of upset about that.
Mm-hmm. If that was pre-Clinton, then what was the executive order that Bush signed putting in place the hiring exemption?
He took it even farther than Clinton did. But the charitable choice laws that passed in 96 mm-hmm. had moved the ball a little bit. In making it more acceptable. Okay. And I think what surprised me was that I was hearing from progressive religious groups who were upset about Obama's formulation, not just the conservative ones, because they were saying places like World Vision or, you know, these big charities are going to have a real problem with that. Again, they sort of swept it under the rug during the campaign in the hope they could work that out. But as of now, I'm not sure that they've really come to terms with that. I don't know. Do you know if they have?
It's not my sense that they have, the faith-based initiative has also not been on the top of their list of things to get done before the inauguration. So I think this is a fight we're going to hear about once he's in office. I would be surprised if they brought it up first thing. On the other hand, he has... the system that's been put in place by Bush that he needs to make some decisions about and presumably overturn some executive orders there, including the one about hiring. If he just overturns the Bush order, as you say, maybe that just brings it back to, you know, the post-charitable choice law of the late 1990s. And that might be acceptable for some of the more progressive religious groups. You know, this has always been an area that kind of confounded me, just because I've talked to some folks who've worked in the Bush faith-based office over the last 8 years, who have said, you know, one of the things we wanted to do was come up with some great examples to bolster what we were doing, to find cases where... you know, some religious group felt pressured to have to hire somebody. And they said, you know, we wanted that because we were the White House. We wanted to be able to show that this is what we were saving religious groups from. And they couldn't come up with examples, just because group after group they talked to said, we are poor nonprofits who have a hard time finding people to work for us. You think we're going to turn people away? That's not exactly a problem that we have. We're not flooded with resumes from people wanting to come work for us.
It was definitely one of those issues that was symbolic than practically important.
Exactly. But, you know, doesn't necessarily take away its power to derail things. So you're right that that's going to be a fight, and I think they're going to get a lot more pushback, and already have heard from folks they think of as their allies in the progressive religious community than they expected. But it is interesting overall that instead of having a Democratic president who comes in and does away with the faith-based initiative, which I think a lot of folks on the left kind of assumed would be one of the rewards of winning back the White House, that Obama seems to have made precisely the critique that some of us in the media have, which is, if you look closely, it's not that this was a slush fund for conservative religious groups. They managed to, in fact, slash the funding for social programs. So nobody was getting more money, not the faith-based groups and not the secular nonprofits. So there's an opportunity here, particularly given the spiraling problems that are coming along with the economic downturn, to really kind of prop up and support some of the faith-based groups that are out there doing the work. I mean, I'm here in Michigan, where I grew up for Christmas with my parents, and in Detroit, the churches are some of the only organizations right now that are available to help some of the folks who are just losing their jobs and losing their homes all over the place. And obviously, we've gone through the whole gamut of constitutional issues over the last 8 years and understand what the lines are of what you can give faith-based groups funds to do and to not do. But there's it's hard to deny, particularly in tough economic times like this, the work that they step in to do where there really aren't other folks filling the gaps.
And the whole nonprofit sector is really in a crisis now. I think this is another story that'll start to emerge in the next couple months. You know, the nonprofit safety net is been devastated by all the same forces that the for-profit economy has. Mm-hmm. So the government's going to have to step in there in some way as well.
Absolutely. Well, on to another uncontroversial political issue. We've already kind of skirted around it, but abortion is an issue that the Obama administration obviously both will have to deal with, because as you've already said, some conservative groups are planning on raising it in conjunction with healthcare reform, but also Obama himself, during the campaign at least, seemed to indicate that he was interested in supporting policies to reduce abortion rates, which is something that some pro-life and some pro-choice Democrats in Congress have been putting together over the last few years. Do you think that that's something he's going to make a priority early on, or does he want to maybe save himself that grief for at least the first year or so of his administration?
Well, yeah, the timing is an interesting question. I think the he's in a bit of a he's put himself in a bit of a straitjacket, because he, on the one hand, talked about abortion reduction efforts, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, he talked about signing the Freedom of Choice Act, which really kind of, in some ways, goes in the opposite direction, or certainly perceived that way. It's not an impossible dilemma to solve, but it's quite hard. And the and I do think that they, to a degree that they probably don't, that most people don't even realize, the progressive religious groups that supported Obama, I mean, you know this better than anyone, when they were out there in those battleground states doing campaigns and ads for Obama, one of the biggest topics they were talking about was abortion reduction. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I mean, when I mentioned this to secular, far left spiritual progressives or secular progressives, that, you know, all these religious progressives who were out of campaigning for Obama, you know what they were campaigning for? They were saying he was going to reduce the number of abortions. They're like, huh? Yeah, that was part of their message. So, and it is important to them, and it's particularly, you know, it's important both the evangelicals and also to some of the Catholic activists. Now, so I think there were a lot of people who went out on a limb to support Obama, saying he's going to be good on abortion reduction, and they will be really horribly disappointed and feel betrayed if he doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. Does he have to do it in the first year? No, probably not, because just the economy is looming so large that I think if he said, I'm just not going to deal with this right now, he could probably get away with it. But the problem is there's all sorts of executive orders he's going to have to deal with. You know, it's always harder to control your agenda than you think it is. Yeah. Timing issues kind of insert themselves. And if he starts doing a bunch of pro-choice executive orders without signaling in some strong way that he is going to do the abortion reduction, you are going to have some angry religious progressives.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It'll be interesting to see. So far, just on the left, pro-choice and pro-life folks seem to be giving him a little bit of breathing space. Some of the pro-choice groups sent a letter over to the transition listing out what their priorities were for the new administration. And they didn't have the Freedom of Choice Act on that list, which I think is partly a recognition that it's going to be tough to get through Congress. But for right now, they're kind of easing up on him. I mean, there's nothing he could really do about it. He said he would sign it. And I think the fact that they're leaving it off the list is a recognition that first it has to get through Congress before he can sign it, and there's no real need to highlight it and put it out there as a controversial issue if they haven't crossed that first hurdle yet.
That's a big deal, actually. I think I'm glad you mentioned that. I think the fact that they did not list Freedom of Choice Act as a priority was a huge breakthrough for Obama.
Yeah.
To not have to deal with that right now gives him so much more flexibility in working through the timing and the particulars of the abortion issue.
Right. But you're also right that there are executive orders to deal with, and one of the things that really hurt Clinton's credibility with a lot of religious folks in 1993 was that he had campaigned on his great slogan, Safe, Legal, and Rare. And I say great just because it was an excellent marketing tool to indicate to a lot of pro-life voters that Democrats believed abortion should be rare. And that was the part of that that he always stressed. And yet, right out of the box, the first thing he did was change the Mexico City gag rule and overturn that, which was something that everybody knew he was going to do. The fact that it was the very first thing that he did in office, and then over the course of his two terms, didn't actually put much policy muscle behind the rare part of safe and legal. He definitely had his team work on keeping abortions safe and legal for women. But the rare part wasn't something that a lot of Catholics or other pro-life Democrats heard much about. And that kind of hurt the party overall in terms of people being willing to believe them when they said, well, of course we don't think abortion is a good thing. Of course everybody thinks that the abortion rate should be reduced. These voters would say, well, where's our proof? What are you actually doing to get us to that point? And so that is something that I think the Obama team is going to need to think through, because it wouldn't be so hard to overturn some of these executive orders if they also were able to show that they had some support for, they were encouraging Congress to tackle some of the abortion reduction legislation that's been in the House, at least for the last couple of years, and there's been some support for it in the Senate as well. But that's something that's going to have to happen in tandem. If it's one without the other, he's going to get himself a lot of grief that I think he'd rather avoid.
That's interesting. I wonder if I've heard talk in kind of Democratic circles of a sort of cynical way of like, why do we really even have to deal with this abortion stuff? If we get health care passed and economic recovery passed, these Catholic voters or these progressive religious people will be totally with us, even if we don't follow through or come through on the abortion issue. They sort of feel like abortion is really a secondary issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, what do you think of that? Do you think that's a mistaken way of thinking?
Or is Absolutely. It possibly true? Yeah, in part because, as you said, that was really the selling point for a lot of pro-life Democrats who maybe have been crossing over in the last few elections to support Republicans, was the idea that you wouldn't be betraying your pro-life beliefs if you voted for Obama, because the end goal should be to reduce the abortion rate, and that he would get you there, not just as well as a Republican administration, but the argument was he'll even get you there more than they would, because the Republican approach is just a purist kind of focus on changing the court and overturning Roe v. Wade, and you've tried that approach for 35 years, that hasn't gotten you anywhere. And they would lay out, you know, these are the steps for making abortion more rare by providing economic supports for women who want to have their babies, by making contraception more available, and that's actually an argument that works with a lot of evangelicals. It doesn't necessarily fly with Catholics, but many evangelicals have fewer concerns about contraception. And there were a lot of pro-life Democrats who stuck their necks out in their communities and said, this is what our guy is going to do, and this is an issue you care about that then gives you permission to vote for him based on the factors you mentioned, economics and healthcare, and things that really strike people closely. But abortion is almost a threshold issue for a lot of voters. If they don't believe that you understand their concerns on that, then even if the economy is pressing them really hard, they can't quite move beyond abortion to vote for you on shared economic values.
It's like this: the gay marriage thing is a little bit of a misleading distraction, in the sense that for at least for the pro-Obama, pro-life people, it really was abortion that's the key issue. Mm-hmm. Not gay marriage.
Yeah, and abortion was what you heard all the time on the campaign trail, right, when it was kind of small groups of social conservatives who either were Democrats or were leaning Democratic. So it's something they can't afford to ignore for the next 4 years.
You know, I've never seen a final... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I've never seen a final polling number on this, but the BeliefNet survey that we did, which is not really a scientific survey, but we had it about 20% of Obama voters, at least who took our survey, were pro-life, mm-hmm. which is, a pretty decent chunk of people.
Yeah, but if it's 20%, that's actually lower than Kerry's percentage, which I think was 22% of his voters were pro-life. A third of Bush's voters in 2004 were pro-choice.
Oh, interesting.
So that's been kind of an imbalance the Democrats have had to deal with, is they need to be able to bring more of their pro-life voters back into the fold, because more pro-choice voters feel comfortable supporting Republicans. But you're just reminding me that I haven't calculated those numbers yet for this year, so I'm curious to go back and figure that out. But we are almost out of time here, so I want to make a special holiday plug for a piece I have on Time.com. We're talking on Christmas Eve. I'm not sure when this is going up on the site. But I wanted to look at the fact that, oddly, most Christians don't go to Christmas or to church services on Christmas Day. Christmas Eve has become kind of the official time to have a religious observance of the holiday, which I find odd just because for the other holiest holiday for Christians, Easter, a lot of traditions do have Saturday night services kind of in anticipation of Easter. But that doesn't preclude, and in fact, far more people show up on Easter Sunday to have the big celebration for Easter Day. And yet the same thing doesn't happen for Christians on Christmas. We show up on Christmas Eve and do our thing, go home, open presents, and that's it. We stay home on Christmas Day. So not much to debate there. But
was that always true, or is that a new thing?
It wasn't always true, actually, and for a lot of traditions, you know, Catholics still consider Christmas to be a holy day of obligation. The 25th of December is the Feast of Christmas, and so that's a day that you need to celebrate on the liturgical calendar. So a lot of Catholics still do go to midnight Mass on Christmas Eve and then go to Mass on Christmas Day. I grew up Baptist, and at our church we would have Christmas Eve service, and then we would go to church on Christmas, but it would be almost less a traditional worship service and more a birthday party for Jesus. We would sing Happy Birthday, Baby Jesus, and we would have birthday cake in the fellowship hall. And so in some evangelical traditions, too, it's treated not necessarily as a liturgical service, but as a time to celebrate the religious purpose behind Christmas. But it was really kind of in the 50s when civil religion took off and family became almost a religious value that I think most American families started to shift the schedule of their Christmas observance. And Christmas Day became kind of this sacrosanct time to be home with the family. Instead of being in church.
So it's not necessarily that they're at the shopping mall. They might be actually doing something profound.
Yes. It could be just as profound. But,
so it's not a sign of the end of civilization or something like that.
It's not necessarily a sign of the end of the civilization.
That's a good note to end on.
Well, thanks for joining me for this holiday edition.